Welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is John Curry, your volunteer reader. We're going to start the program today with a piece from KSAT News in Austin, Texas. It's entitled, "I'm Just Happy to Get to Explore. 12-year-old boy overcomes disability to pursue sports adventures," by Zarla Oates. A 12-year-old boy is turning heads on and off the court. His name is Finley McCaig. Finley is a Boy Scout and has a disability that impacts his ability to walk, but doesn't stop him when it comes to sports. Finley has scuba dived and played rugby, basketball, tennis, and track and field. He lives in Austin, but travels across Texas to ensure he gets to explore and live his life to the fullest. In Boy Scouts, he's the only one with a physical disability, Finley's mother, Dawn McCaig, says. At the same time, we don't let that stop him. Finley's family has found a way to make everything he wants achievable despite his disability. With support from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, and his parents, Finley achieved his Boy Scout camping badge at Lost Maples State Natural Area. The badge requires several challenges to be accomplished, including a 5-mile hike. The hike would not have been possible for Finley without the assistance of an action track chair and a grit chair, which are terrain-accessible wheelchairs. To have any experience in sort of the natural trail experience, there's no way without the equipment, McCaig said. I think the collaboration with the state parks folks was amazing and really helped to make it possible. Jessica Burke, accessibility manager for TPWD, said, "Access to inclusive hiking measures like their parks are pivotal for people with disabilities." Burke explained that TPWD offers wheelchairs designed for upper body strength, allowing users to push levers to move the chair instead of walking. Others can also push those wheelchairs. "We have about 20 of those chairs in our system across all the state parks," Burke said. "I saw the wheelchairs first online," Finley's father, Chris McCaig, said. "I'm like, this thing is going to be great at some point. I had no idea that the state parks had any of them to bring out." Finley said that initially using the wheelchairs was difficult, but once he got used to getting the chair over rocks and gravel, it became pretty fun to use. "My hope will probably be to be able to become a Paralympian," Finley said. "But for now, I'm just doing all these different sports so that I can get that experience." TPWD said it has plans to increase the number of accommodating wheelchairs it has across the state. The entity also has plans to improve assistance for visually impaired people. "We ask people to give us 2 weeks' notice if they need an ASL interpreter, if you need something printed in Braille, if you need a wheelchair at a specific site," Burke said. "It's definitely something that Texas Parks and Wildlife is invested in and wants to make sure that we are providing lots of opportunities. I'm just happy to get to explore at an early age so that I can figure out what I want to do with my life," Finley said. And now from CBS News, U.S. looks to end subminimum wage for workers with disabilities, by Kate Gibson. The Department of Labor is proposing to phase out a controversial Depression-era program that lets some employers pay disabled workers less than the federal minimum wage. Federal law currently allows the agency to issue certificates that let employers pay certain workers less than the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour, based on the notion that their disabilities hinder productivity. Intended to help those with disabilities gain employment, the law currently has about 40,000 American workers laboring for half the minimum wage or less, according to the Labor Department. Many earn less than half. Some earn just pennies on the dollar, Taryn Williams, Assistant Secretary of Labor for Disability Employment, said at a Tuesday news briefing. The agency has issued a proposed rule that would immediately stop the issuance of certificates that let employers pay less than the federal minimum and start a 3-year phase-out period for the hundreds of employers that currently hold the permits. The Labor Department's proposal follows a review of the program, and the new law would not take effect until a public comment period ends on January 17, 2025, days before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. The new administration could review and respond to the comments and issue a final rule or withdraw it entirely. Still, even if the proposal is not enacted, subminimum pay for those with disabilities could become a thing of the past, as more than a dozen states and the District of Columbia have already banned the program. The Illinois legislature recently passed legislation to end subminimum wage for disabled workers by 2029. California, Nevada, and Virginia are also phasing out the program. Initiated under Section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, the program was initially meant to provide jobs for injured military veterans. As things currently stand, many disabled people work in what are called sheltered workshops, run by certified employers that pay as little as 25 cents an hour. As of November 1st, more than 37,000 workers in 37 states were paid subminimum wage by 710 certificate holders, according to government data. Another 35 employers had their certificate renewals pending. This next piece comes from Fox News. It's entitled, "Elton John's Vision Loss: How an Eye Infection Can Cause Blindness." Infections can be more dangerous among the elderly, an optometrist warns, by Angelica Stabile. World-renowned singer-songwriter Elton John confirmed he has lost sight in his right eye after suffering from a severe infection. On the opening night of his musical adaptation of The Devil Wears Prada in London, John shared, "I haven't been able to come to many of the previews because, as you know, I've lost my eyesight. So it's hard for me to see, but I love to hear it, and boy, it sounded good tonight," he said. John first posted to his Instagram account in September that he had been dealing with a severe eye infection over the summer that has unfortunately left me with only limited vision in one eye. Since Sir Elton John did not state what type of infection he has, it is unclear whether he has complete blindness in his right eye or if there is still some partial vision, Dr. Thu Tran, optometrist and founder of Oculist in New York City, told Fox News Digital. It is possible that he may still be able to perceive light and motion, but is unable to discern enough detail to read letters or musical notes, added Tran, who did not treat the singer. He may also be experiencing other signs and symptoms, such as thick mucus discharge, pain, irritation, excessive tearing, and redness. Types of eye infections. The most common types of eye infections are viral conjunctivitis and bacterial conjunctivitis, according to Tran. Viral conjunctivitis, caused by adenovirus, are like common colds and typically resolve on their own within a few weeks, she said. When caused by herpes simplex virus, varicella zoster virus, same virus that is responsible for chickenpox and shingles, or cytomegalovirus, seen in immunocompromised individuals, i.e. those with HIV/AIDS, more serious complications such as corneal scarring, retinal damage, and vision loss may result. Bacterial eye infections usually resolve within a week with proper antibiotic treatment, usually eye drops or ointment, the doctor said. A hyperacute bacterial eye infection, however, can be severe and rapidly progressive, Tran warned. If not treated immediately, it can lead to corneal ulcers, scarring, and blindness. This condition is most commonly caused by Neisseria gonorrhea, a type of bacteria that can be transmitted through sexual contact. Fungal eye infections are often caused by fungi that are naturally present in our environment, according to Tran. Common risk factors include trauma to the eye with plant material, extended contact lens wear, and diabetes, she said. Fungal infections are usually treated with topical or oral antifungal therapies. Rarely, they can lead to a medically urgent condition known as endophthalmitis, which often requires hospitalization for administration of intravenous medication. Potential for permanent damage. Dr. Derek Cunningham, eye doctor and director of Dell Laser Consultants in Austin, Texas, also spoke with Fox News Digital about the dangers of both internal and external infections in the eyes. An internal infection can be caused by a virus, said Cunningham, who also did not treat Elton John. If it reaches the retina or the back of the eye, permanent vision loss can occur. More commonly, eye infections are the result of external triggers and trauma to the front of the eye, like scratches, chemical splashes, or the misuse of contact lenses, he noted. These incidents then allow bacteria and other foreign organisms to colonize in the eye, Cunningham said. Because the eye is specifically designed to transmit light, the cellular structure of all the tissues is very precise and it cannot be altered. So, any amount of immune response or even bacterial or viral infection is going to cause not only a disruption in the cells, but it could potentially cause scarring, and that is going to reduce vision, very often on a permanent level, he went on. While the eye is sensitive and may have a harder time warding off infection since it's a compartmentalized system, Cunningham said, the cornea is also the fastest healing tissue in the human body. But as people age, the body heals more slowly. So someone like Elton John, who is 77 years old, will be at a higher risk of elongated infection compared to those who are younger. A little kid can scratch their eye and, within hours, be completely healed, Cunningham said. In an elderly person, injury can last for days, and that's where the chance of infection builds up, every minute that the tissue is still compromised. Some eye complications can be spotted and addressed early on during routine eye exams. Cunningham recommends paying attention to visual function, and if vision is compromised, symptoms should be evaluated by a doctor. If there is anything really infectious in the eye, the potential for vision loss is extremely high and it's permanent. It very often doesn't ever come back. Representatives for Elton John did not return Fox News Digital's immediate request for comment. Now, this next article comes from Marketing Week. The level of disability representation in this year's Christmas ads, shameful, says advocacy groups. Brands are both failing to sufficiently represent the disabled community, a group that accounts for 16 million people in the UK, and missing a significant growth opportunity at the same time, according to the Valuable 500, by Josh Stevenson. Just 6% of the Christmas ads broadcast in the UK this year featured a disabled person in the creative, according to new research from the Valuable 500. Out of the 50 ads the advocacy body analyzed, only three, O2, British Airways, and Smythe's Toys, featured a disabled person, and even then, only in a fleeting role. Each of the three instances featured someone in a wheelchair in the background of a shot. Disability representation has been under the microscope for the advertising industry since Channel 4 brought to light in 2020 that just 3% of TV adverts in the UK featured a disabled person. This number rose slightly to 4% in 2022, but the number of adverts with a disabled person in the lead role was stagnant both times at 1%. This is despite the fact there are 16 million people in the UK with a disability, roughly 24% of the working population, and globally, 1 in 5 people are disabled. For Katie Talikowska, CEO of the Valuable 500, who spent 2 decades working agency side at AMV BBDO, the level of representation in this year's Christmas adverts is shameful. She was surprised at how bad it was. "I had to watch the ads multiple times to actually identify the person in a wheelchair within the ad because it was so incidental and so fleeting," she told Marketing Week. "And this is someone who was actively looking after being told there was representation. For me, it's shameful, and it's worse than tokenistic." Talikowska acknowledges that not all disabilities are visible, and so it is possible the protagonists in the ads identify as having a disability. She notes, too, that representation also matters not just in front of the camera, but behind it, too. And so, makeup of the creative agencies who worked on these campaigns would be interesting to know. But, even with those caveats, considering Christmas has such incredible reach and is such an important period for brands, 6% is too low a number and amounts to brands ignoring large swaths of the population. She points to Boots as an example of a brand that has done fantastic workaround representation when it comes to race and sexual orientation, and its festive campaign continues that good work. But there were missed opportunities within the creative. "There were a lot of close-ups of people getting ready to go and have a party, which everyone wants to do at Christmas, irrespective of your abilities. And you could have so easily cast a deaf actor putting on makeup with a hearing aid," she said. "There are sophisticated, really authentic ways of representing people with disabilities and disabilities that are non-visible. And missed opportunities come in more ways than not representing the audience fully." Talikowska points to Valuable 500's own research, which shows the disabled community represents $13 trillion in spending power worldwide and £274 billion in the UK. But yet only 2% say they feel represented in the advertising and communications they consume. Marketers are obsessed with growth, right? That's why marketers exist. It's all about growing your brand and growing your market share, she says. Given that obsession, why would you ignore or siphon off 20% of your potential target audience? She encourages the advertising industry to stop thinking about the disabled community as a separate individual silo target market, and instead to recognize that people with disabilities are all of us and shouldn't be treated any differently. Talikowska believes there's no intent behind the advertising industry's continued reluctance to market to the disabled community. Rather, it simply isn't on their radar, and when it is, they jump to the obvious visual cues, like a cane or a wheelchair, instead of tackling the harder work of showcasing non-visible disabilities. A lot of this, she posits, comes down to recruitment. If you don't have disabled voices within your organization to be the voice of the disabled consumer throughout the creative process, then it is no surprise that it's not going to be thought about. It's systemic. I think the problem would be massively solved if the workforce representation and the self-disclosure rates of people with disabilities within marketing and advertising teams was higher. It should be nationally representative, she says. The Valuable 500, which has secured the support of powerhouse brands like Microsoft and Google, will be launching a tool to help tackle some of these issues in 2025. Dubbed the Authentic Representation Tool, ART, it aims to help brands assess how accessible their marketing offerings are and how well they represent disabled people within their content, offering action plans and putting them in contact with disabled groups. When you talk to marketers, and I talk to my former advertising colleagues, they have good intentions, but they're not sure where to start or what good looks like, she says. What is evidenced by this year's Christmas ads is a clear industry problem. Marketers don't know how. And now, a piece from 9 News in Aurora, Colorado. The title, CU Anschutz Researchers Working to Cure Blindness Through Total Eye Transplantation. Dr. Kia Washington has her sights set on tackling total eye transplantation in 10 years. By Rachel Kraus, Aurora, Colorado. More than 1 million Americans are blind, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and millions more have vision loss. Researchers at the University of Colorado, Anschutz Medical Campus, are hoping to restore vision to many through total eye transplantation, and a $46 million award from a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services program will help them do that. Something great is going to come out of this, even if it's not what we expect, said Dr. Kia Washington, professor of surgery at CU Anschutz. I've been studying this for over a decade, actually, and with the hopes of this becoming a clinical reality to help our patients that are suffering from blindness. And I do feel that with the resources and the award provided by the ARPAH agency that it's now within reach. Washington said their research will need to tackle restoring vision after an eye transplant by regrowing or regenerating the optic nerve. Part of that is finding a way to actually repair the optic nerve and reduce scarring during the surgery. And the other part is tapping into our innate kind of intrinsic ability to regrow the optic nerve. And so we're looking at ways to manipulate genes in order to do that, Washington said. This kind of work is tricky, Washington said, in part because of how our ability to see is connected throughout our bodies. The eye is an extension of your brain and is essentially part of your brain, so we consider it to be part of the central nervous system, Washington said. The work is far from easy, but can make a big difference for many. I actually get emails from patients all the time that are looking to get eye transplants or be part of a clinical trial for eye transplantation, and some really touching stories, especially from some of the wounded service members that have had trauma to their eye and, you know, want to see their children again. Really touching stories, Washington said. I'm so happy that hopefully one day we will be able to help those patients. She said this is high-risk, high-reward research with CU Anschutz leading the charge. Washington has her sights set on tackling total eye transplantation in 10 years. We're shooting for the moon, shooting for the stars, and we know something great is going to come out of it, Washington said. CU Anschutz is leading the project, and the work will be done in collaboration with a number of other institutions around the country, including Johns Hopkins University, the University of Southern California, and the National Eye Institute. And now, from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC sues Alto Experience, Incorporated for disability discrimination. Federal agency charges ride-hailing company denied accommodations and employment to deaf individuals. Washington. Alto Experience Incorporated, a ride-hailing company that currently operates in Texas, Florida, and California, and previously operated in the District of Columbia in Virginia, violated federal law when it denied reasonable accommodations and employment to deaf and hard-of-hearing individuals who applied to work as personal drivers, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, alleged in a lawsuit filed today. According to the lawsuit, Alto refused to hire qualified deaf and hard-of-hearing individuals for its personal driver position despite the ready availability of technological accommodations and, in some instances, despite previous experience as drivers for other ride-hailing companies. The EEOC also alleged that some qualified deaf and hard-of-hearing individuals who were denied accommodations or employment as personal drivers were steered into a less desirable car washing positions. During the hiring process, Alto also failed to provide communications accommodations, such as American Sign Language, ASL, interpreters, the EEOC said. Such alleged conduct violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, which prohibits discrimination in hiring against qualified individuals with disabilities and requires employers to provide reasonable accommodations to qualified employees and applicants with disabilities if doing so would not pose an undue hardship. The EEOC filed suit, EEOC versus Alto Experience Incorporated, case number 124CV-2208, in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia after first attempting to reach a voluntary pre-litigation settlement through its conciliation process. In the lawsuit, the EEOC seeks back pay, compensatory and punitive damages for the aggrieved individuals, and equitable relief to prevent future discrimination. This lawsuit demonstrates the need for employers to implement available technology when qualified individuals with disabilities need reasonable accommodations, said EEOC Philadelphia Regional Attorney Deborah M. Lawrence. Mindy E. Weinstein, director of the EEOC's Washington field office, said, "The EEOC is committed to protecting the rights of deaf and hard-of-hearing individuals. Too often, employers make incorrect assumptions about their capabilities and do not understand how to provide effective communication accommodations." For more information on disability discrimination, please visit https://www.eeoc.gov/disability-discrimination. The EEOC's Washington field office has jurisdiction over Washington, D.C. and parts of Virginia. Attorneys in the Philadelphia District Office prosecute discrimination cases within the jurisdiction of the Washington field office. The EEOC prevents and remedies unlawful employment discrimination and advances equal opportunity for all. Next up will be a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled "New Rule Expands Disability Rights in Air Travel" by Sean Heasley. But before we move into that article, let me remind you that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, John Curry. And now that article from the Disability Scoop. Federal officials are finalizing a rule that they say will yield the largest expansion of rights for airline passengers with disabilities in a generation. Under the regulation published this week, the U.S. Department of Transportation will mandate better training for airline staff and contractors who assist people with disabilities, as well as those who handle wheelchairs. In addition, the rule enhances the expectations for how assistance is provided and what must occur if a wheelchair is damaged or delayed. Every passenger deserves safe, dignified travel when they fly, and we've taken unprecedented actions to hold airlines accountable when they do not provide fair treatment to passengers with disabilities, said Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. With the new protections we're announcing today, we've established a new standard for air travel with clear and thorough guidelines for airlines to ensure that passengers using wheelchairs can travel safely and with dignity. The rule stipulates that airlines provide safe and dignified assistance to passengers with disabilities, meaning that they are served in a manner that does not put them at increased risk of bodily injury and that respects their independence, autonomy, and privacy. Airline staff and contractors who provide physical assistance to people with disabilities or who handle wheelchairs or scooters will be required to undergo annual training starting no later than June 17, 2026. In addition, the rule mandates that individuals with disabilities receive prompt assistance when getting on and off aircraft and making connections. Airline staff must be available to help those who use a boarding chair deplane when the last passengers who do not require assistance exit the aircraft, and the passenger's personal wheelchair must be positioned as close as possible to the door of the plane, the rule states. The regulation also makes it an automatic violation of the Air Carrier Access Act if airlines damage or delay the return of a wheelchair or another assistive device, and it entitles passengers with disabilities to new protections if an airline mishandles their wheelchair or scooter. In such an event, a loaner must be provided, and passengers will be able to choose if they want the airline to handle any repairs or replacement, or if they prefer to make arrangements themselves at the airline's expense. Wheelchairs or scooters that are delayed must be returned to the passenger within 24 hours for domestic flights, the rule states. If a person's wheelchair or scooter does not fit in the cargo hold on their flight, or if mobility devices are not loaded onto an individual's scheduled flight for any reason, airlines will be expected to rebook passengers with disabilities on the next available flight at no cost, the Transportation Department said. The rule also sets new standards for the design of onboard wheelchairs that will be phased in starting in October 2026. The Transportation Department notes that an estimated 5.5 million Americans use wheelchairs. Data shows that airlines damage, delay, or lose one out of every 100 wheelchairs that are transported on domestic flights. The final rule will take effect January 16, 2025, though some provisions will not be implemented immediately. Next, we have a piece from Stateline entitled, States Go After Claim Sharks That Charge Vets for Help with Disability Claims. The practice is legally questionable under federal law, but there's no penalty for flouting it. By Anna Claire Vollers. For-profit consultants across the country make millions each year by charging military veterans for help in filing their disability claims with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The practice exists in a legal loophole. It's illegal under federal law for companies that aren't accredited by the VA to charge veterans fees for helping file their disability claims. But there's no criminal penalty for breaking the law, and many consultants contend that the services they provide aren't explicitly forbidden. Recent attempts to regulate this for-profit shadow industry have stalled in Congress. While some state lawmakers are trying to close the loophole by filing bills to restrict the practice, they're up against their legislative peers and a cadre of industry leaders with a stable of lobbyists who want the loophole sealed into place at the state level. Three states, Maine, New Jersey, and New York, passed laws in the past year cracking down on for-profit consultants. Similar bills were introduced in 17 other states. Meanwhile, Louisiana enacted a law hailed by the for-profit industry as a win. It allows companies to charge up to $12,500 in fees for a task that veterans service organizations such as the American Legion will do for free. The issue is pitting veterans against one another. When we have organizations and companies out there like these claim sharks that are preying on our veterans and taking away their hard-earned benefits and making a profit off them, there's something empirically wrong with that, said Missouri Republican State Representative Dave Griffith, a former Green Beret in the U.S. Army 8th Special Forces Group. Griffith introduced a bill earlier this year that would impose criminal penalties on those receiving compensation for helping a veteran apply for benefits. The bill died in committee, but Griffith has refiled it for the upcoming legislative session. What's even more disturbing to me, said Griffith, who served in Vietnam, is that many of these organizations are run by veterans. The for-profit consulting industry argues that veterans should have the freedom to hire whomever they want to help them navigate the VA's plodding, glitchy application process. Disability claims currently take 4 or 5 months on average to resolve, according to VA data, though some languish for a year or more. Some veterans have reported that the expense is worth it, and have chided the government for not doing a better job marketing directly to vets about how to get their benefits. The companies charging exorbitant fees, industry representatives say, are just a few bad apples. The key for us is having transparent disclosures, processes, and statements of fees so veterans can make informed decisions, said Peter O'Rourke, president of the National Association for Veteran Rights, a newly formed trade association for the claims consulting industry. O'Rourke, a U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force veteran, was formerly acting Secretary of Veterans Affairs during the Trump administration before he was forced out in 2018. O'Rourke estimated he and his team have been to 38 states to testify at committee hearings and speak with legislators. There's a better way of doing business, and we need to have more of that discussion versus going back in time and criminalizing what the market has been able to provide veterans, he said. Promises and profits. The urgency from all sides of the issue follows Congress's passage 2 years ago of the PACT Act, the largest expansion of veterans' benefits in generations. It offers disability-related benefits for veterans suffering from the effects of Agent Orange, toxic burn pits in recent wars, and other toxic exposures over the past several decades. Under the Act, millions more veterans could qualify for aid. That increased funding represents a potential bonanza for private consultants who promise to help military veterans access it for a price. Veterans with a service-related disability, from cancer to asthma to depression, can apply to receive a monthly cash benefit from the government. Their checks could range from $500 to more than $4,000 per month. Depending on the severity of the disability and other factors, such as their number of dependents. But getting approved takes months. The claims process, sluggish and riddled with glitches, according to veterans and the VA's own data, requires a lengthy application and detailed medical documentation. Enter the private claims consultant. For a fee or a cut of a veteran's future disability benefits, often 5 times what the veteran stands to receive from the VA, amounting to thousands of dollars, the consulting company promises to help smooth the process and maximize the veteran's disability check. Veterans are often facing delays with the VA, and I can see why there's a desire to get results. But these companies sometimes use exploitive practices and seize a big chunk of your benefits, said Florida Democratic State Representative Anna V. Escamani. She partnered with Republican State Representative Michelle Salzman, an Army veteran, to introduce a claim shark bill in the most recent legislative session. The bill died in committee, but Escamani said they plan to continue talking with veterans and introduce a similar bill next session. Since January, Republican and Democratic lawmakers in at least 17 states, from Rhode Island to Mississippi to California, have introduced bills to ban or restrict private claim consultants from profiting off veterans. Most are based on the Federal Guard Act, currently stalled in Congress, which would impose penalties on unaccredited consultants who charge veterans for claims filing assistance. Organizations such as the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the American Legion have been outspoken supporters of the Guard Act and similar state efforts to rein in for-profit consultants. Last year, New Jersey became the first state to make it illegal for anyone lacking VA accreditation to charge a veteran for assistance filing a disability claim. Maine and New York soon followed. The VA grants accreditation to attorneys, veterans service organizations, and other claims agents that meet certain requirements, such as a background check and a written exam. Organizations such as the VFW and the American Legion provide their services for free, though attorneys and agents are allowed to charge fees to assist with some claims, including appeals. Griffith, the Missouri legislator, modeled his bill after the New Jersey bill. When he first began researching the issue, he said, he didn't like what he saw. Often, he said, companies will charge a fee for their services equal to 5 times the increase in the veteran's monthly benefit. For example, a new veteran approved for 100% disability receives about $3,800 per month from the VA. For help filing that claim, a consulting company might charge a one-time fee of about $19,000. In some cases, Griffith said, consultants can pocket as much as $30,000 through tactics such as holding on to a claim for months before filing so they can take their cut from the substantial back pay that the VA eventually awards the veteran. Criticism and pushback. O'Rourke said his group is in favor of some legal guardrails at the federal or state level to protect veterans from exploitation, such as setting certain limits around fees or requiring transparency in contract agreements. But, he said, private consulting should be freely available because the VA and its current accreditation process haven't kept up with the needs of veterans. We're looking at, after 20 years of war, a strain on our social infrastructure when it comes to how we take care of veterans, he said, noting that the VA's claims and appeals process is decades old, complex, and cumbersome to navigate, even with accredited groups offering help. Asking veterans to go into a system that uses a lot of their time and causes frustration, veterans are going to try to find workarounds for that. Groups, including the VFW, have been vocal opponents of for-profit consulting companies, urging lawmakers to take action and waging public relations battles against the industry. For-profit companies have been investigated by media and officials in states including Texas and Louisiana for potentially illegal practices. Last year, the VA issued a fraud alert warning veterans to avoid consultants who aren't accredited. But the industry is pushing back. One of the largest for-profit consulting companies spent more than $800,000 last year and $780,000 this year in federal lobbying efforts, according to data compiled by the nonprofit Open Secrets. That included pushing for a bill that would make the legal loophole permanent. At the state level, representatives from some of the industry's largest players are showing up in state houses across the country to speak against bills. "I got very close to getting my bill passed last year," said Griffith. "But claims consulting companies hired a lobbyist in Missouri," he said. "They lobbied the House Speaker's office, and he delayed the bill." During a committee hearing, Missouri legislators heard opposition to the bill from O'Rourke, who also testified against Escamani and Salzman's bill in Florida. "I was surprised at the amount of money they're willing to spend to try and keep things the way they are," said Escamani, who said she didn't expect to see such a concerted effort to stop a bill in its first committee meeting. In June, Louisiana quietly enacted a law that will allow unregulated companies to profit from assisting veterans with their disability claims, though it caps consulting fees at $12,500. Republican Governor Jeff Landry allowed the bill to become law without his signature. It marked an about-face for Landry. When he was the state attorney general, he worked to shut down the types of consulting businesses the law now explicitly allows. Similar bills were introduced this year in Arizona, Georgia, Hawaii, and Kentucky, but did not pass. Last month in Alabama, members of the Legislative Committee for the State Veterans Affairs Department voted to work with state lawmakers on a bill to prohibit claims consultants from profiting off veterans. The issue is likely to show up again next year in state legislative sessions around the country. This next article comes from the New York Times. It's entitled, "Guggenheim Offers the Poetry of Motion, Sign Language Verses." The museum's Poet in Residence for 2024 is putting poetry by deaf and hard of hearing artists on display. By Ilara Paragni. Noah Buchholz, a deaf poet, was standing on a stage on the ground floor of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum on Wednesday night with a gentle smile. His left and right hands intermittently motioned forward as his fingers spread open like little bursts of fire and joy. He was performing a poem inspired by his deaf grandmother's experience in a school that forbade students to use ASL, recalling how she and her friends at the dorm would gather at night by a window to sign in secret. "This is what sign language poetry, a genre rooted in the sign language tradition, looks like, a feast for the eyes." Buchholz was one of the poets invited to showcase their poetry for an event, Sound Off, organized by the Guggenheim's 2024 Poet in Residence, Meg Day. Day, who is deaf and uses they-them pronouns, has spent the year working on highlighting sign language poetry, a well-established artistic form within deaf culture that has received little recognition among wider audiences. Among Day's initiatives is Ekphrasis in Air, a display of sign language poetry on the sixth floor of the Rotunda in the Harmony and Dissonance exhibition devoted to orphism. Nestled between two areas broadcasting readings of poetry by Guillaume Apollinaire and Blaise Cendrars are three video screens projecting poems in American and British sign languages, including by Day, Douglas Ridloff, and Abby Haroun. "These poets are represented and thoughtfully presented," Day said, adding, "This is a different kind of attention." Among deaf people who sign, ASL poetry is known as a growing art form with a rich history. Signed poems are increasingly available on video, and events like slams and festivals offer a space for deaf artists. But Day's residency brings the art for the first time to the Guggenheim, a setting where it has the potential to reach audiences who have never experienced it. Day said that central to their endeavor was a desire to recognize a language in a form that many people struggle to see as such. I think a lot of people would really push back on the idea that there is a deaf literature at all, Day said, or would feel that if it exists in ASL, then it can't be literature. The seven poems featured in the installation are all examples of ekphrasis, or poetry that is created in response to a visual work of art. Buchholz, a director of the ASL program at Princeton University, said that the connection between a genre like sign poetry and the visual arts would seem natural, since sign languages are inherently visual. But historically, ekphrasis has not proved very inclusive. That is just an example of how many aspects of sign language and deaf culture have yet to be discovered or become widespread, he added. Now that society has largely acknowledged the existence of deaf culture and sign language, it is time to delve deeper into deaf culture and learn more about the contributions it can make to mainstream society, said Buchholz, whose poem, Reflecting on the Guggenheim, is also part of the display. Rosa Lee Tim, whose poem Echoes in the Round is in the exhibition, said, I'm thrilled to be part of something that elevates ASL poetry to such a respected artistic space. Sign language poetry, like written poetry, is an elaborate art form that stretches the possibilities of language through rules and techniques. But with its visual nature, it can add a new dimension, the poets participating in the project point out. ASL poetry offers an incredible depth of expression through the use of location. A sign normally at the forehead, for example, can be moved somewhere else, as well as hand shapes and facial expressions, Tim said. A single sign choice can evoke a variety of thoughts and emotions depending on how it's performed. ASL poetry's dynamic quality allows for a manipulation of space and movement that written poetry can't quite capture, she added. The physicality of the language adds layers to the meaning and emotional impact. Poets are able to push the boundaries of the genre by developing their own style. Buchholz, for example, said, his poetry blends common elements of spoken and written poetry, such as wordplay and rhyme, with distinctive elements of sign language poetry, like spatialization, which involves changing a sign's location, and classifiers, signs whose hand shape, location, movement, or palm orientation may be manipulated to depict a detail. The poems in ekphrasis are displayed without captioning, an intentional choice made by Day and the other poets. Day said that the assumed audience at the Guggenheim is hearing people, and they sought to shift the balance. The issue of captioning feels political, they said. Viewers without sign language knowledge are guided through the display by the author's explanatory notes and invited to enjoy the videos as they would other artworks. People move into the Guggenheim anticipating that they will see things they don't necessarily understand, Day said, and there's a welcome comfort with that. There's an invitation to curiosity. Ridoff's poem, Cosmos, for example, takes on an orphism work by František Kupka, The Colored One, an abstract painting devoted to people communing with nature. On video, Ridloff, one of the most popular contemporary ASL poets, uses his fingers to point in various directions at increasing speed until his hands in front of his chest almost create energy before diverting in a motion evocative of an explosion in space. Later, his left hand cups his right fist, which slowly starts pulsating like the beating heart of a new life. Raymond Lukzak, who contributed the poem Guggenheim Fair, said he would not be upset if visitors didn't understand my poem. In fact, he invites museum goers to turn off the English in their heads. Experiencing something wholly foreign can be life-changing, he said. For Sound Off, Day decided to bring together deaf and hard-of-hearing poets. Among them were Sam Rush and Kamisha Jones, as well as Raymond Antrobus, whose work is also in Ekphrasis in Air, who composed to various degrees in sign language and English in the hope of setting off a nuanced conversation about poetry and deaf poetics. Day said they hoped it would help people understand the complexity and the expansive possibility of poetics when we include things that aren't English text. For Haroun, who became deaf at age 8 and holds an MFA in Poetry and Creative Writing from the University of Baltimore, participating in the initiative was an opportunity to explore a different side of her art. Writing poetry is easy for me, but to perform a poem in ASL is no easy feat, she said. Haroun, who contributed On Brooklyn Bridge to Ekphrasis in Air, added, "This is the kind of exposure and encouragement that I needed. It's invaluable growth." At Sound Off, Haroun performed a poem celebrating being a Black deaf woman. Her hands twirled increasingly higher, eventually separating in opposite directions and coming back down to her sides. Her interpreter recited, "Tonight, I'm going to be Maya Angelou, signing poems that spiral sky high." Michael Coffer, a deaf retired teacher in attendance who also runs a deaf film camp, said that it was about time that a space like the Guggenheim welcomed ASL poetry. "I'm thrilled, and I hope that there will be more," he said through an interpreter. "I hope that this isn't the first and the last." Joanna Cruz, the hearing child of deaf parents, was in the event with their friend, Sarah Lebrandi. "It was just incredibly touching, seeing poetry signed for the first time," Cruz said. "It's not something I've ever experienced." Lebrandi said she was impressed by how expressive the poetry was and how much she could pick up without knowing ASL. "I feel very privileged to be welcomed," she said, "as someone who is not part of this community." Also among those in attendance was Peter Cook, a deaf poet who, along with his hearing partner, Kenny Lerner, has been sharing ASL poetry for decades through their Flying Words project. As the event came to a close, he was beaming. "The theme is just beautiful diversity, different generations of poetry," he said through an interpreter. "So much of what he saw felt new," he said. "The inclusion of people with different experiences of hearing loss, the work of interpreters in this space, the incorporation of different visual styles. And this is an international museum, and for it to acknowledge ASL as the language of art is perfect. This is the perfect venue for that," he said. We are out of time. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News Program. And please tune in again next time.